Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Good morning, everyone. It's a great honor for me again to welcome you to participate in our annual Holocaust Remembrance Day. This day marks really the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and forms an important aspect of Holocaust remembrance. We've been honoring this day in this particular fashion now for probably half a dozen of years at least, and it all began by me doing something which at the time didn't make me very popular with my faculty, David Patterson and Zhuzhanna Arshvat, and that was I gave them the charge to come up with the 18 most important Holocaust poems. And they both looked very angrily at me because they both felt that I asked them something quite impossible. But with a lot of talking about ongoing work and convincing, they in the end produced this little booklet. And that was important for us because it formed the basis then of our translation work. Every year we pick out one of these poems that ideally we like to translate into many languages as possible so that on this day we honor the remembrance of the Holocaust, but you know, by using our various languages as a way also really of indicating that the remembrance of the Holocaust is really a universal phenomena that resonates in each one of these languages. So that's, you know, starting part. Then we've also from the beginning have always built this out with lots of other partnerships with other faculty. Extreme Burrow will introduce one of the projects. It's actually right behind you. You're almost sitting on top of it without you knowing it in the little alley behind it. And then we've also asked our university choir to join in with us, along with various volunteers who are going to recite poems today in English, in Turkish, in German, and other languages. But let me just say like a few words just about Holocaust remembrance and why I think it is important. I mean, we're doing this every year. So the question is really, is it every year the same or has it acquired for us a different significance? And it strikes me that these days, the larger history of the Holocaust encompassing early on the history of harassment, intimidation, marginalization, the experience of loss of home, of refugees, of incarceration, slave labor, war, and then the ultimate genocide really resonates with us, probably in ways in which we would not have anticipated 10 or 15 years ago. What I'm trying to get at is that unfortunately, quote unquote, its relevance, if anything, has become probably more prevalent these days and more kind of called upon than ever. It is probably fair to say that Zhuzhi, who held the Paul Lewis chair when she created with the help of community friends that chair in the 1990s, that Holocaust remembrance was seen as vital, as a kind of remembrance of what humanity ultimately is capable of, but also as something that seemed very distant at the time, as something that was receding into the background and needed to be recalled and remembered, but which had less, I think, that more, you know, contemporary or even kind of future forward-looking relevance that it unfortunately has acquired today. And that it has that, I think, is also something that is acutely felt really here on campus with as many students from so many different countries from around the world who invariably feel the various distresses and conflicts, whether they are from Ukraine or from places of Africa or indeed from other places around the world, more so these days than ever. So that in lots of ways, our COMET community is both connected with the cultures of the world, but also with the conflicts of the world. And I think we probably in the last 2 or 3 years have felt this also more than ever. So for me, Holocaust remembrance remains something that is important to all of us. I was just talking briefly before, and Professor Patterson and I, we've been busy this weekend, right? That would be fair to say, because Holocaust remembrance is not just important here on our campus, but also in our communities. And therefore, we together, I think, delivered 4 different lectures just over Saturday and Sunday in different occasions, because this matters. And people also remember it in different ways. Our synagogue just down the street, Beth Torah, annually engages in a different type of process. It invites also speakers, but it reads out the names and does this every year and continuously, which is also a very memorable practice. For us, I think reciting poems and And performing and engaging in art is something that is in tune with what our kind of verbiage, our vernacular, so to speak, of the School of Arts and Humanities and Technology. So thank you, therefore, for being here and participating and quite literally giving it your own voice.
A Cartload of Shoes by Abraham Sutskever, translated by David G. Roskies. The wheels hurry onward, onward. What do they carry? They carry a cartload of shivering shoes. The wagon, like a canopy in the evening light. The shoes, clustered like people in a dance. A wedding? A holiday? Has something blinded my eyes? The shoes, I seem to recognize them. The heels go tapping with a clatter and a din. From our old Vilna streets, they drive us to Berlin. I should not ask, but something tears at my tongue. Shoes, tell me the truth. Where are they, the feet? The feet from these boots with button like dew. And here, where is the body? And there, where is the bride? Where is the child to fill those shoes? Why has the bride gone barefoot? Through the slippers and the boots, I see those my mother used to wear. She kept them for the Sabbath, her favorite pair. And the heels go tapping with a clatter and a din. From our old Vilna streets, they drive us to Berlin.
Thank you. Good morning. I have just a little background on the poem and the poet. Abraham Sutskever was from Vilna. He was one of the Vilna ghetto fighters. He later became a partisan fighter. He survived the Vilna ghetto uprising in 1943, went into the forest surrounding Vilnius, ended up in, after some months in Moscow. He wrote a chronicle of the uprising and a brief history of the Nazi occupation in Vilna. In 1946, 47, the Soviets decided to dissolve what was known as the Anti-Fascist Committee, which consisted mostly of Jewish Russian Jews who had gathered information about the Nazis, including the Vilna ghetto uprising, Nazi occupation of the East. And they compiled it under the leadership of another writer, Ilya Ehrenberg, into what's known as the Black Book of Russian Jewry. The Soviets tried to confiscate and destroy every copy they could, but Sutskever got one remaining copy, although it was incomplete. He smuggled it out of Soviet Union, took it to Israel, and ended up in Yad Vashem. So he was responsible for preserving hundreds of pages of eyewitness testimony. He then lived in Israel, was well known as a Yiddish poet before and after the war. The poem, A Vulcan Sheikh, a wagon of shoes. A wagon here is a train car, okay? A Vulcan is a train car. It's a train car load of shoes. You may have seen photos from the period, from the Shoah in camps, where you see piles of shoes that would fill this space. The Germans collected the Jews' belongings before they murdered them, sorted them out in warehouses, and sent them to Germany. So this is an image of course, shoes are very powerful images. Shoes designate, a path that we walk. Jewish law, it's not called law, it's halakha, which means walking a path, the path that you tread, the trace that you leave, the footprints that you leave are all, associated with shoes. When the temple stood, people would remove their shoes before entering a holy space. So these shoes have been removed before these Jews entered a holy space, so to say. There's a reference in the poem, you'll hear the whole thing in English very shortly, but there's a reference to a chuppah. A chuppah is a wedding canopy. It's the first dwelling space for a couple who comes together in marriage. The word for marriage in Hebrew, Yiddish, it's kiddushin, which means holiness. Dwelling places are spaces of holiness. This is why we mark them with a mezuzah, a container of Torah, scriptures, right? That's what's coming under assault here. The holiness, holy one. In 1922, in an interview, Hitler said, when he comes to power, he will see to the extermination of the Jews. 1922. His friend, Hermann Rauschning, says that Hitler indicated to him that he, Hitler, would destroy the tyrannical God of the Jews and his life-denying Ten Commandments. This is a war against Torah, against the Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, against the God of Israel, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the chuppah signifies this thing. In the third stanza, you see, is it a holiday, a wedding? The word translated as holiday is yontif, which means not holiday, but holy day. Like Passover is a yontif. We just had Passover. It's a day of prayer. It's a day of connecting with God. It's a day of dancing. In Jewish tradition, dancing is a form of praying. If you've ever seen Hasidim dance, then you know what I'm talking about. It's a way of ascending. Notice also a couple of stanzas have very pronounced images of children. I see the shoes, but where are the feet? Where are the children? Were designated first targets. Children and elders were the first to be murdered. The Nazis created realms entirely void of children. I read a memoir by George Salton. It's called The 23rd Psalm. He said he went 6 years without seeing a single child. Children, we're taught in the tradition. Suskaver knows all of this, by the way. It's through children that our prayers reach God's ears because their lips are untainted by sin. All of creation, the Talmud says, is held up, is sustained by the breath of little children, not by the powerful shoulders of Atlas, not by power, but by holiness. There are many other teachings about children, and like in all other traditions, the Jewish teachings have their own expression of the holiness of the children. The source of meaning, the life of our soul, stems from our children. The Nazis murdered more than 85% of the Jewish children of Europe, almost 9 out of 10. If the Jews' crime is being in the world, the most heinous of criminals is the mother who brings that Jew into the world. Not just mothers, but motherhood. The very notion of mother was under a radical assault. Being pregnant was a capital crime. Women in the camps were placed in the impossible position of delivering a baby, that one of their, you know, their friends has a baby, and killing the infant to save the mother, because they would both be killed were it discovered. My mama's shoes. He's an orphan. The poet, the voice is the voice of an orphan. Almost all of the survivors were orphans, had no parents. Almost all of them. I've known many survivors in my time. They've told me, you know, in the DP camps, they would have weddings and they would celebrate at the weddings. A friend of mine said it was like other weddings, except there were no parents. Okay, no parents. He remembers, he associates his mother with the Sabbath, the Shabbat. Sabbath, the word Sabbath, Shabbat, is one of the names of God. Sabbath is when the Holy One enters this realm. And of course, the Nazis prohibited Sabbath observance. Right. Lighting the candles. The candles signify the divine presence. It's the woman of a household that brings the Holy One and holiness into the home, not the man. My mama's shoes, okay. Where they're taking us from the ancient Vilna alleys to Berlin. Vilna was the center of Jewish learning, of the sages, from the 16th century till the Shoah. Vilna was the center of learning. We still, today, the most widely studied edition of the Talmud is the Vilna Shas, so-called, the Vilna edition of the Talmud. So a little background on Suskaver, context for this poem, ways in which it conveys what the Shoah is exactly. It eludes representation. It eludes utterance. The task of poetry is to give voice to the ineffable. And so that's what these poets that you will hear from today are trying to do. They're trying to give voice to something that can't be named. You know, as Churchill said, we're in the presence of a crime without a name. I'm here to share a Russian translation of A Wagon Load of Shoes. Колеса, которые они тащат и таскают, что они приносят и чьи? Они привозят с собой повозку, наполнен пульсирующими туфлями. Повозка, как хопа, в вечернее сияние очаровывает. Туфли складывались и нагромождались, как люди в танце. Праздник?
Свадьба? Ослепительно, как празднество. Обувь знакомая, раскидистая. Я знаю их всех. Каблуки постукивая без злого мысла. Куда? 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 Из древних берлинских аллей они везут нас в Берлин. Я не должен спрашивать вас, чьи. Мое сердце, оно попускает удар. Скажи мне правду, обувь. Куда исчезли ноги? Ножки насосов такие дрянья, с пуговицами, как роса. Где маленькое тело? Где тоже женщина? Вся детская обувь. Но где? Все ли детские ноги? Почему невеста не носит? Ее туфли такие яркие и аккуратные. Среди саба и детских сандалий туфли моей мамы я вижу. В субботу, как свечи, она не добьела их ликование. Каблуки пустыкают без злого мысла. Куда? 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 Из древних берлинских аллей они не везут нас в Берлин.
I'll read through the original Yiddish by Sutzkever. It will sound, if you speak or read German, very much like German, like a medieval German. As Kafka said, if you speak German, you know more Yiddish than you think you do. Yiddish is a fusion language, according to linguist Max Weinreich, of German together with a Slavic and a Hebrew component.
Avogen sich, die Räder jogen, jogen, was bringen sie mit sich? Sie bringen mir Wogen mit Zappeln dicker Schicht, der Wogen wie Ruppe in Ofen dicken Glanz, die Schicht a fuller Kuppe wie Menschen in a Tanz. A Rasene, a Jontef, sie hat mich wer verblendet, die Schicht a Säune neunte aufs Nei Chob der kennt. Es klappen die Obsassen, wohin, 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 von alte Wilner Gassen, mit treibt uns kein Berlin. Ich darf nicht fragen, wem es nur's tuten Harzer riss. O sagt mir Schich, dem Emmes, wo sennen sie die Fiss? Die Fiss von jener Tuffel mit knäpplich wie Toi. Und do, wo ist das Gufel? Und dort, wo ist die Freu? In Kinder Schich in alle, wo seh ich nicht kein Kind? Wo's tut nicht on die Kalle, die schichlich erzint? Durch Kinder Schich und Grabes, der kenn mein Mames Schich. Sie fleckt sie bloß auf Schabe, sie räuft sie in auf sich. Uns klappen die Obsassen. Wohin? 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 Von alter Wilner Gassen betreibt uns kein Berlin.
For my grandmother who lived. A translation into Swedish of A Cartload of Shoes. En vagnslast med skor. Hjulen rullar, rullar fram. Vad bär de med sig, tro? De bär en packad vagnslast av skälvande skor. Vagnen som en trupa i skymningsljusets glans. Skorna böljar i en hög som människor i dans. Ett bröllop kanske, en helig dag. Jag kanske är förbländad. Skorna, de ser nästan ut som människor jag känner. Klackarna klapprar. Vart hem? Vart hem? Vart hem? Från Vilnius äldsta gator. De för oss till Berlin. Jag viskar tyst en fråga. Mitt hjärta slutar slå. Och säg mig skor. Vems fötter har ni hört hemma hos? Vems fötter bär de tofflor vars knappar är som tack? Och dessa... Var är flickan? Var är kvinnans andra plagg? Barnskor, barnskor, överallt, men inga barn syns här. Brudens skor är tomma och ingen brud finns där. Bland tofflor, slitna barnskor, jag ser min mammas par. De sparades till sabbaten, de finaste hon bar. Och klackarna, de klapprar, vart hän, vart hän, vart hän. Från Vilnius äldsta gator, de för oss till Berlin.
I translated Abraham Suskever's poem to Turkish. I will read it to you in Turkish. Bir araba dolusu ayakkabı. Tekerlekler hızla ilerliyor, ilerliyor. Ne taşıyorlar? Bir araba yükü taşıyorlar. Titreyen ayakkabılar. Vagon bir gölgeli gibi akşam ışığında. Ayakkabılar kümelenmiş, dans eden insanlar gibi. Bir ayıklama mı, bir tatil mi? Gözlerimi bir şey mi kör etti? Ayakkabılar tanıyor gibiyim. Topuklar tıkırdıyor. Bir şangırtı, bir gürültüyle. Eski Vilna sokaklarımızdan bizi Berlin'e götürüyorlar. Sormamalıyım ama bir şey dilimi yırtıyor. Ayakkabılar bana gerçeği söyle. Ayaklar nerede? Bu botların ayakları dev gibi düğmelerle ve burada ceset nerede? Ve orada köprü nerede? Çocuk nerede? O ayakkabıları doldurmak için köprü neden? Yalın ayak mı gittin? Terliklerin ve botların arasından annemin eski giydiklerini görüyorum. Onları Şabat için sakladı. En sevdiği çift. Ve topuklar tıkırdamaya başladı. Bir takırtı ve gürültüyle eski Vilna sokaklarımızdan bizi Berlin'e götürüyorlar.
I translated the poem A Cartload of Shoes into German. Die Räder eilen vorwärts. Vorwärts. Was tragen Sie? Sie tragen einen Wagen voller zitternder Schuhe. Der Wagen wie eine Überdachung im abendlichen Licht. Die Schuhe versammelt wie Menschen bei einem Tanz. Eine Hochzeit, ein Feiertag. Hat etwas meine Augen geblendet? Die Schuhe, ich scheine sie wiederzuerkennen. Die Felsen klappern mit Lärm und Gedöse. Von unseren alten Wilner Straßen führen sie uns nach Berlin. Ich sollte nicht fragen, aber etwas zerreißt meine Zunge. Schuhe, sagt mir die Wahrheit. Wo sind sie, die Füße? Die Füße von jenen Stiefeln mit Knöpfen wie Dau. Und hier, wo ist der Körper? Und dort, wo ist die Braut? Wo ist das Kind, um diese Schuhe zu füllen? Warum läuft die Braut barfuß? Durch die Pantoffeln und die Stiefel sehe ich die Schuhe, die meine Mutter immer trug. Sie hat sie für den Sabbat aufbewahrt. Ihr Lieblingsbar. Die Felsen klappern mit Lärm und Gedöse. Von unseren alten Wilner Straßen führen sie uns nach Berlin.
This is a piece that was written by my grandmother's sister to memorialize her aunt. My family, most of my family, were able to leave in 38, but my great-great-aunt was not. From Sisters by Joelle Beer, Part 1, Frieda Bierretter. Not everyone in my nuclear family had a brother. My mother and dad did, but we all had a sister. And it was my father's sister, Frieda, who in my child's eyes always embodied love. It's not easy to draw a portrait of a person from a memory of 48 years. Yet Frieda left such a powerful impression that I may succeed. Her features were peaceful and gentle, unlike her life. Her hair was bright and beautiful, white, without the benefit of beauty aids. It was like a crown. Her body was not especially graceful, yet her every move was like a dance. Her hands were coarse and worn from farm labor, yet they were firm and strong and gentle too. I shall never forget her eyes. Her eyes caressed you with an understanding. Her eyes held all her pain that she somehow, in a divine alchemy, transformed into love and compassion. I hardly remember her voice. She spoke more with eyes and hands and movement than with words. Frieda was married to a tyrant. She had two sons. They lived on a farm in the Sudetenland. Uncle Ludwig acted like the land and his family owed him a living, and they all toiled hard as the animals,
as he strutted about and shouted. No matter how angry Ludwig became, Frieda didn't provoke. I never felt she was a victim or weak in any way. She maintained poise and dignity in all situations. My Aunt Frieda never read the New Testament, but she lived the passage in 1 Corinthians 13, 24 hours a day. Her love indeed was long-suffering and kind. She did not envy my mother, although my mother had a life of luxury and a devoted, kind husband. I believe my father was a little split in his loyalties because he truly loved both women, his wife and his sister. When my mother, who tended to be a little jealous of Frieda, once asked him, "If Frieda and I were in deep water and about to drown, who would you save first?" Without hesitation, my father said, "Frieda, of course, you can swim." And yet when, in the fateful year of 1938, both of his beloved women were about to drown, he was helpless to save Frieda. She died because of a stubborn, puffed up husband to whom she was immensely loyal in the end, in Theresienstadt. My father had made it possible for them to escape along with us to the safety of the United States. But my uncle believed none of my dad's dire predictions and insisted on staying in the homeland where it couldn't happen, as it had in our homeland in Austria only months before. My guess is that Frieda comforted and helped many fellow prisoners with her loving acts of kindness that she showered on us every summer of my childhood until the last summer of 38, which separated us forever. In these summers, I never saw her rest, yet she never seemed rushed. She was always working, milking the cows, stuffing the geese, mixing a cake, tending the vegetables, making a yummy Eierlikör. Yet she always had time to listen, to bind a wound, physical or otherwise, to encourage, to tell a bedtime story, or to bring a special snack to my sister and me. We had a few letters in America. There was never a complaint, though perhaps it would have been censored anyway. But she always saw the best in everyone and so forgave her tormentors, even in a concentration camp. The evil that men do or did to that gentle, loving soul must be remembered. All the good that she did must not be forgotten. Her sons are dead, so who will remember if I don't tell her story to my children and nieces, each of whom is lucky to have a sister? Thank you.
I'm going to be reading number 12, Testimony, by Dan Pages, translated by Stephen Mitchell. No, they were definitely human beings. Uniforms, boots. How to explain? They were created in the image. I was a shade. A different creator made me. And he, in his mercy, left nothing of me that would die. And I fled to him, rose weightless, blue, forgiving. I would even say apologizing. Smoke to omnipotent smoke, without image or likeness.
I'll be reading a poem by Nelly Sachs, Udi Schornstein in Deutsch and German. Und wenn diese meine Haut zerschlagen sein wird, so werde ich ohne mein Fleisch Gott schauen. O die Schornsteine, auf dem sinnreich erdachten Wohnungen des Todes, als Israels Leib zog aufgelöst in Rauch. Durch die Luft, als Essenkehrer ihn ein Stern empfing, der schwarz wurde, oder war es ein Sonnenstrahl? O die Schornsteine, Freiheitswege für Jeremias in Hiobs Staub, wer erdachte euch und baute Stein auf Stein? Den Weg für Flüchtlinge aus Rauch? O die Wohnungen des Todes, einladend hergerichtet für den Wirt des Hauses, der sonst Gast war, o ihr Finger, die Eingangsschwelle legend, wie ein Messer zwischen Leben und Tod, o ihr Schornsteine, o ihr Finger, und Israels Leib im Rauch durch die Luft.
I wrote this poem in Berlin when I was there at the invitation of the German government to study Jewish life after World War II. And we were in a section where the trains were departing for concentration camps, just blocks away. And here I was studying how different Germany was now well, that was actually last century. But so I wrote this poem, and I guess I'll read it. It's called Blood. The blood that soaks the earth and merges into tidal waves of pain has known no borders, nor color of the skin, nor gender or religion. The trail of death lives deep within the common suffering of snuffed lives, the cries of grandmothers, mothers, sisters, cousins, husbands, and all who still had souls and bodies, whose tortured limbs were torn as sport and then discarded as waste in pools of endless blood. Remorse, promises, then alternate cycles that just change targets, and yet atrocities remain, continue. Restart after pauses and regroup in configurations of self-righteousness, self-validation, ancestral memories, wantonness, and the cruelty of indifference. We live the Holocaust in ourselves, in genocides that precede and follow. We mourn the victims as we slay again. We pray and then erase the words. We blind ourselves and then deafen to all that fights the scripts we know and simply slide into the rigid, easy path, the comfort zone where paralyzed is our spirit, closed is the mind, numb is the heart and frozen shut the empty road we need to fill. Not through the blood that soaks the earth. The Jews, how much must they endure? They give so much and shine so much through history and teach and lead and follow in the path they wish to share and offer prophets and the book and all that could be, if only their martyrdom and suffering is far beyond just blood or numbers, but constant vigilance of more. And in my own lifetime, the Nazi plague, Russia, Rwanda, Congo, Cambodia, Sudan, and so much of Africa, Tibet, Yugoslavia, China, and so many, many more smaller, larger pools of blood that run into deep crevices of being and spill throughout the present and far into the past. Is there no other way, no lesson that will teach how to evolve us human, as what it is meant by one? Become the messenger and message, the prophet and the light, and understand and care with love, respect, when not only blood unites us. I step into the lush greenery and cast a final glance at the beauty of yet another lovely, waning, warm spring day. And I do hear the casual singing of a bird, not knowing, not caring, that my heart is longing for another dawn, another way. I carefully sift the sand through open fingers, and a chant comes to my lips for all those buried, for all those who came this way before me, for all those who will come to bury others and not care. And I know that the seasons will continue as before, even though I'm now changed, that I shall cherish not only the road, but where it leads. And I shall walk tall, even if the wind still roars against me. And I shall speak to those who listen and cry with them until our tears will merge as blood that scatters, drowns into itself, and makes way for what's to come. And I shall plant the seeds and hold all hands, embrace and kindle hope. And I shall laugh and sing and dance for all who wish to join, and change may bless all grandchildren who will not know. Yet I will know that all I am and all I do is all I can. And I hope that's for you too.
Never shall I forget. By Mr. Elie Wiesel. Never shall I forget that night, the first night in the camp, which turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed, seven times sealed. Never shall I forget the smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of children whose bodies I saw transformed into smoke beneath a silent sky. Never shall I forget those flames that consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence that deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments that murdered my soul and my God and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. Never shall I forget is from the book Night by Mr. Wiseau.
My name is Angie Simmons, and I am reading the poem History and Reality by Stephen Spender. I escaped from Germany, cared for by English friends with whom kindness counted still. Rumors reached her, photographs made by the Gestapo. Jews, her people, so various, all one, each taken full face, the strong, the meek, the sad, the proud. Hunger had stretched the parchment skin across the contours of the bone, forehead, cheekbones, chin. And in each face, there was the same ultimate revelation of eyes that stare upon the real, some terrible final thing. She locked herself inside her room, her mind filled with those images from Germany, her homeland, where those deaths were the reality. Real, not some tragedy that actors performed before an audience. Pity and terror purifying the onlooker, enraptured by poetry secreted in the lines. But where the players were the victims massacred from a tyrant's mouth. She felt a kind of envy for those who stood naked in their truth, where to be one of her people was to be one of those millions killed. She starved her body to pure thought, to be one with her people snatched from ghettos by the SS, then hurled into cattle trucks and trains, hurtling all night across bare plains, till dawn, where they there stood, waiting on platforms of sidings below walls of concrete and barbed wire, guards who marched them to a parade ground. Were those fit to work in factories? Were separated from the rest, women and children, the old, the sick, who taken to a yard were robbed of jewelry, satchels, playthings, shoes, things that to them meant home and name, and made to stand there when a voice from a watchtower proclaimed they would be cleansed of lice and being Jews. Then thrust inside a shed where she, through her intense imagining, stood there among them bodily, when from outside the guards turned on taps through which hissed not water, but the murdering gas, whereon that crowd breathed a great sigh of revelation. Their life, their death, for her the real, instant where history ground its wheel on her with them inside that moment, when outside truth was only words.
I'm going to read You Onlookers by Nellie Sachs. Whose eyes watched the killing? As one feels the stare at one's back, you feel on your bodies the glances of the dead. How many dying eyes will look at you when you pluck a violet from its hiding place? How many hands will be raised in supplication in the twisted, martyr-like branches of old oaks? How much memory grows in the blood of the evening sun? Oh, the unsung cradle songs in the night cry of the turtle doves. Many a one might have plucked stars from the skies. Now the old well must do it for them. You onlookers, who raised no hand in murder, but who did not shake the dust from the longing, you who halted there where the dust is changed to light.
I'm going to be reading the opening statement of the Nuremberg Trials number 9, which is considered the Einsatzgruppe trial. It is fitting to do this today because on Friday, 10 April, we lost Mr. Ben Ferenz. He passed away at his home, and he was a man that was dedicated to the efforts with the International Criminal Court to advancing his goal of replacing the rule of force with the rule of law. In 1947, the International Military Tribunal conducted a second set of war crimes trials, known as the subsequent Nuremberg proceedings. The ninth trial of those extended proceedings, known as the Einsatzgruppe trial, was led by a then 27-year-old chief prosecutor of the United States, Mr. Ben Ferencz. The following is his opening statement. May it please your honors, it is with sorrow and with hope that we disclose the deliberate slaughter of more than a million innocent and defenseless men, women, and children. This was the tragic fulfillment of a program of intolerance and arrogance. Vengeance is not our goal, nor do we seek merely a just retribution. We ask this court to affirm, by international penal action, men's rights to live in peace and dignity, regardless of his race or creed. This case we present is a plea for humanity to law. We shall establish, beyond the realm of doubt, facts which before the dark decade of the Third Reich would have seemed incredible. The defendants were commanders and officers of special SS groups known as Einsatzgruppe, established for the specific purpose of massacring human beings because they were Jews or because they were, for some other reason, regarded as inferior peoples. Each of these defendants in the dock held a position of responsibility or command in an extermination unit. Each assumed the right to decide the fate of men, and death was the intended result of his power and contempt. Their own reports will show that the slaughter committed by these defendants was dictated not by military necessity, but by that supreme perversion of thought, the Nazi theory of the master race. We shall show that these deeds of men in uniform were the methodical execution of long-range plans to destroy ethnic, national, political, and religious groups, which stood condemned in the Nazi mind. Genocide, the extermination of whole categories of human beings, was a foremost instrument of the Nazi doctrine. Even before the war, the concentration camps within the Third Reich had witnessed many killings inspired by these ideas. During the early months of the war, the Nazi regime extended its plans of genocide and enlarged the means to execute them. Following the German invasion of Poland, there arose extermination camps such as Auschwitz and Majdanek. In spring 1941, in contemplation of the coming assault upon the Soviet Union, the Einsatzgruppe were created as military units, but not to fight as soldiers. They were organized for murder. In advance of the attack on Russia, the Einsatzgruppe were ordered to destroy life behind the lines of combat. Not all life, to be sure. They were to destroy all those denominated Jew, political official, gypsy, and those other thousands called asocial by the self-styled Nazi Superman. This was new German Kultur. Einsatz units entering a town or city ordered all Jews to be registered. They were forced to wear a Star of David under threat of death. All were then assembled with their families to be resettled under Nazi supervision. At the outskirts of each town was a ditch where a squad of Einsatz men waited for their victims. Whole families arrayed, kneeling or standing near the pit to face a deadly hail of fire. Into the prisoner of war camps went the Einsatz units, selecting men for extermination, denying them their right to live. Helpless civilians were conveniently labeled partisans or partisan sympathizers and then executed. In the hospitals and asylums, the Einsatzgruppe destroyed the ill and insane, for useless eaters could never serve the Third Reich. Then came the gas vans, vehicles which could receive living human beings and discharge their corpses. Every Einsatzgruppe had its allotment of these carriages of death. Then these, in short, were the activities of the Einsatzgruppe. The United States in 1942 joined 11 nations in condemnation of Nazi slaughters and vowed that justice would be done. Here we act to fulfill that pledge, not alone, but because of it. Germany is a land of ruins occupied by foreign troops, its economy crippled and its people hungry. Most Germans are still unaware of the detailed events we shall account. They must realize that these things did occur in order to understand somewhat the causes of their present plight. They put their faith in Hitler and their hope in his regime, the Nazi ideology devoid of humanism and founded on a ruthless materialism, was proclaimed throughout Germany and was known to all Germans. Hitler and other Nazi leaders made no secret of their purpose to destroy the Jews. As we here record the massacre of thousands of helpless children, the German people may reflect on it to assess the merits of the system they so enthusiastically acclaimed. If they shame at the folly of their choice, they may yet find a true ideal in place of a foul fetish. Proof of a million murders will not be the most significant aspect of this case. We charge more than murder, for we cannot shut our eyes to a fact, ominous and full of foreboding, of all of mankind. Not since men abandoned tribal loyalties has any state challenged the right of a whole peoples to exist. And not since medieval times have governments marked their men for death because of race or faith. Now comes this recrudescence, this native doctrine, a master race, an arrogance blended from tribal conceit and a boundless contempt for man himself. It is an idea whose toleration endangers all men. It is, as we have charged, a crime against humanity. The conscience of humanity is the foundation of all law. We seek here a judgment expressing that conscience and reaffirming under law the basic rights of man. Mr. Ferenz is quoted as saying in later years, "Nuremberg taught me that creating a world of tolerance and compassion would be a long and arduous task. And I learned that if we did not devote ourselves to developing effective world law, the same cruel mentality that made the Holocaust possible might one day destroy the entire human race."
I want to thank, first of all, everyone who participated today, students, staff, friends from the community, professors, the choir, and so on and so forth. But I think we've ended in a very befitting manner. We were still fortunate to welcome Ferenc 2 years ago in the middle of the pandemic at one of our conferences where he was still able to join us virtually. But it does remind me of something that's really important, that in many ways, as we began thinking about Holocaust remembrance, we need to conclude and kind of remind ourselves that there is no memory where there's no truth and where there's no justice. Therefore, it's a very befitting way to end our remembrance today, that in many ways, these three, when it comes to the Holocaust, but also to other forms of mass violence, truth, justice, and memory always have to coexist. Without the other two, none of them can exist by themselves. Thank you all very much for being again here and for being part of our extended community, and also being able really to see the wonderful students and faculty and staff that we have, and everyone else who participated in making that happen, all the way also to our Director of Technology, David Butler, who's made sure that we had volume and sound. And also again to Cindy Seaton Rogers, who put it all nicely together. Thank you, everyone.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies.
You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.